Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Note. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is venture capitalist partner, Jean-Louis Gasset. Jean-Louis, thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All of us at the Mac Observer, thank you. I've been a fan of yours ever since you arrived at Apple. I've been following your career all the time that you've been working at Apple and B. And Dave Hamilton, the publisher of the Mac Observer, was a big fan of BOS. He wants to say, hey, hello, and he loved BOS when you were working on it. So, and all the team, Brian Chaffin and Jeff Gamet, are big fans of yours. So we are absolutely just delighted to have you on the show.
Great. Thank you.
So for the listeners who may not be quite familiar with your career, one of the things we do in Background Mode is we sort of go back and find out how you arrived. You're most famous for having been an Apple executive, and currently your Monday notes, which are glorious and wonderful, and I follow them all the time. But let's go back in time a little bit. I was looking at your career, reminding myself, when you were young, what was it about your growing up that steered you into the kinds of things you were doing? Tell me about your early years, even before you started with Hewlett Packard.
Well, I started building radios around the age of nine, I think. These were pre-transistor radios, and my first radios were very simple AM devices with a detector, as we use a iron sulfide crystal. It was a crystal radio.
Oh, cool. You know,
with a little needle that you look for a good place on the crystal, so you could get a good detection.
And you had some capacitors in there to set the resonant frequency, right?
Yeah. So yeah, the capacitor and a winding of a wire, and then we had a variable capacitor. I had a variable capacitor to set the wavelength. Then I moved to lamps. My first lamp tube. Sorry, I'm translating from French. My first tube was a 1LN5, a pentode, and
vacuum tube.
Yeah, vacuum tube. Yeah. And then I moved I remember going to a boarding school in 1955. I was 11.
This was Paris, right?
I was, I lived in Paris, but I was sent, I was a bad kid, so I was sent to a boarding school in Brittany. And the prefect of discipline, that was his title, was a geek. So that was my real, real, really big luck. That he loved electronics, so I remember drooling in his office at the first OC71 transistor, germanium transistor, and then I moved on, and then life became complicated. I dropped out of college because the family just completely broke down. And so I was on the street. So I had a number of very interesting jobs, but that's not for this audience. And then I joined Hewlett Packard France in 1968. In June of 1968, they hired me. That was another stroke of luck to launch their first desktop computer in the French market, the 9100A. And because I was a geek at heart, I understood the product better than the people hiring me. So when they saw my enthusiasm for the product, I guess that sort of clinched the deal. So I rapidly...
I remember those computers. We loved them. I was in college, And Hewlett-Packard was making the most awesome scientific calculators.
There you go.
And I used one in my professor's office that he let me use for my numerical analysis and my physics calculations. And these were awesome computers. They were expensive.
They were
geared to the scientist, and we loved them.
Yeah. No, I had a ball there. But then I got, I climbed the ranks. I ended up I got out of the field, got into a staff job at the European headquarters in charge of all the south of Europe. After a while, I got bored, so I hired myself as a turnaround artist. And I did a turnaround job at a mini computer company in France called Data General, a Boston or Westboro company.
Is that when Data General was trying to build mini computers that competed with the PDPs and so on?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this was an interesting company There is a book about one of their computers by Tracy Kidder, K-I-D-D-R, called The Soul of the New Machine.
Oh, I remember that book. Oh, yeah. Famous. And
so I was there. I was there in those times. Then I did another turnaround job for when Exxon was hypnotized by the Boston Consulting Group into... They're diversifying into information technology.
Wait, is this the Exxon we know and love, the oil and gas company?
Yeah.
Or what?
Yeah.
I'm curious about that. How did Exxon possibly think that they needed to be into office automation or whatever?
Yeah, because the hypnotists at the BCG told them that, rightly actually, that information technology was the oil of the 21st century. That is correct, as we know.
Magic words.
Exxon had the wrong culture. So after a few months there, I decided I needed to get out.
How did Exxon do in that project? I mean, what kind of projects were they involved in?
They invested about $2 billion in buying companies such as Quix, Quip, Zilog, Videc, Intecom, which was a telephone switch company based on the Perkin-Elmer data systems mini computer.
So they were just trying to buy their way into the technology companies.
Yeah.
Did they do anything creative and did they build anything?
No. They put $2 billion in. Then they had to make things work. They spent another $2 billion before giving up. And remember, in the late 1970s, $2 billion was real money.
Yeah, I'll say.
So then I used to meet for Kremlinology, by which I mean I used to poke fun at IBM's press releases. So I sat with a Gartner analyst in Paris, and we joked around looking at all the pablum to stay G-rated at all the evasions and half-truths that IBM's PR was spewing. And then he mentioned casually that he could get me as a thank you for some tip I gave him on another company. He could get me Apple IPO stock in 1980. And I said, no, I don't play the stock market. Remember, I'm a repentant mathematician, so I know the casino always wins. So,
if only you knew.
Yeah, well, I said, no. And he said, oh, by the way, Apple is looking for someone to start their subsidiary in France. So I told the gent was named Aaron Orlansky. I told Aaron, look, this is me. He said, "What? You're working for this great company, Exxon Information Systems?" I said, "No." So he introduced me to Tom Lawrence, the VP Europe. We hit it off immediately, so they hired me to start Apple France.
Were
so
you sensing at the time that this personal computer revolution that Apple had launched was something that was really important?
I always thought that personal computers were important. To me, the day I got this first job at HP, they were in more than one ways personal computers, as you noted rightly. They were exceedingly expensive, so they were not personal, really, in the sense that a normal person
right.
could get one.
The physics department would buy one and everybody would use it.
So, but still, there were the personal computer, because a personal computer is an extension of your mind and body. That's what personal computers are. They help you think, they help you organize, they help you learn, they help you communicate, they help you play. There are some, this is a very simple category system, taxonomy, if you want to be fancy, of things that personal computers do to extend the reach of your mind, because you can't do long divisions inside your head. And the computer does it very, very easily. It extends your body in communication and so on. So to me, going at Apple was a natural. I said, of course. That's a no-brainer.
What was the scale of Apple's operations in Europe at that time? Because I know they took a long time to really get ramped up.
They were very small and not very well organized, which played in my favor, because I started from scratch. I remember signing my contract in Geneva and thinking, if I can hire these two people I knew from previous job, I'm saved. And I did hire them, and I hired a third guy, an ex-IBM guy, as the VP of sales. And we had three guys who carried me on their shoulders.
So Apple Europe was three or four of you.
No, the Apple France. I'm talking about Apple France. Europe was just a few guys in an office building in a close suburb of Paris. Mm-hmm. And my job was to start Apple's fully owned distribution company in France.
Okay.
So I did that. We did that. Unfortunately, I lost two of these three people to tobacco cancer. So don't smoke.
And this was what, about 1981, 82?
Yeah. So I started early 1981, and I did that for close to 5 years. Apple France became the largest Apple business outside of the U.S. and very profitable, and so it was a joy, and so that did wonders for my reputation. And one thing led to another. I got hired to take over engineering in Cupertino.
Wait a second. Back to France. So were there particular problems with integration of the Apple II at that time, being an American product into French in terms of documentation, the basic language?
Well, we just did that. To me, it was like falling off a log. It was so obvious. It was obvious what we had to do. And I got lucky enough to put together a team of competent people who knew what to do. So we never had any question or doubt about what to do. Apple was already a fairly profitable, rich company, so we had the means to do what needed to be done. And so, to paraphrase our departed Steve Jobs, it just worked. It was obvious.
Yeah, with the Macintosh, we have been accustomed to localization, where you can go in and change the language of the entire system. But the Apple II was pretty primitive and not quite so flexible in that regard.
Yeah, but we translated the documentation and people, remember, this was prior to the Macintosh, where personal computers, the competition was not very user-friendly either. So, no, we had dedicated users who loved to program in BASIC, who loved to use, remember, VisiCalc, PFS, PFS Graph, which was the triad of applications I used to give demo of a sort of business type of applications. And then I use a Raster Blaster, Pinball Construction Set by the immortal Bill Budge.
You're bringing back some memories.
to demonstrate how fast the Apple II was when properly programmed. People couldn't believe you could do a pinball construction set, meaning you could rearrange the bumpers and everything, the flippers and everything, and then play pinball on a 1 megahertz computer.
I was just going to mention that. 1 megahertz, right?
1 megahertz.
Not 1 megaflop. It was like 1 million simple instructions per second.
So, and the computer I'm sitting in front of right now is a 3,000 times faster. Actually, it's more than that because it has multiple cores and whatnot and graphics support on a separate processor. So this was it was easy. I'm sorry. Of course, people thought Apple management used to end its tour of Europe by Apple France because everything worked. In other countries they had trouble with this, trouble with that. We just had a grand time. So
I diverted you there for a second. So eventually you came to John Sculley's attention, right?
Yeah, and John Sculley came to Paris in 1983, gave a very good speech. I congratulated him on that speech. So we hit it off. One thing led to another. The Mac was introduced, didn't work initially, didn't work very well, I think. I think unfortunately, Apple marketing at the time fell for trying to fight the IBM PC on its enterprise ground. Something we steadfastly refused to do in France. We said, no. There is no way to win against the IBM PC. In large companies, let's go elsewhere. There was enough territory. And again, they looked at us and said, "Wow, how can you do that?" Said, "Well, look at our numbers. Customers understand that if you need an enterprise type computer, buy a PC XT later PC 80. The holy terror was the PC 80 with a hard disk. A color screen, remember, a color screen which the Mac didn't have, running Lotus 1-2-3, which was the first integrated business with word processing, spreadsheet, graphics, and database. So you had
that's a formidable opponent.
And it was written in assembler, an assembly language. So with a PC 80 or even a slower PC XT, Lotus 1-2-3 was a holy terror. And I don't like to go bare-breasted in front of a bunch of machine guns. We had no interest in that. So we looked at people in the more creative professions who loved the Macintosh. for the right reason, because it was easy to use for non-technical people.
A lot of guests have told me that when they saw Mac Paint on the first Macintosh, they instantly fell in love and they knew instantly what to do with it.
Yeah, exactly. And very quickly, there was the Laser Writer, which cost $7,000 at the time, but was a wonderful printer. You know, this is, you know, what Steve Jobs and his team did with the original 128K Mac. Remember, 128K, all right?
Lots of floppy switching.
It had a network stack. It had the AppleTalk networking stack inside. Mm-hmm. You know, it also had a LaserWriter driver in ROM. So you had a computer which was capable of doing wonderful documents on paper, or we quickly learned on acetate. You know, before PowerPoint, we used retro projectors and overhead projectors and you know, foils, acetate foils, and you could do wonderful foils. And so we had plenty of marketing departments and PR organizations and creative people all loved the Mac. So we had no trouble, no sense of shame, because we didn't look at ourselves as inferior to the IBM PC.
Oh, no, you went off on desktop publishing with the laser printer,
right.
and
we said
created a whole new thing.
Yeah. So we had a good life. So one thing led to another. When Steve left the company, I was given the reins to the engineering department.
I want to talk to you about that some more after the break, but if it's okay. Right now, we just have to take a short commercial break. We're going to hear from Kelly. Folks, we'll be right back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Kelly. We're back. I'm chatting with Jean-Louis Gasset. So we were talking about when you started taking control over Apple products. When was this, about 85 or so, right?
Yeah, 85. Spring of 85.
What was the big challenge? Now, you had desktop publishing under control. People were using the Mac. Art departments were grabbing up right and left. Was this about the time when you started thinking that because of the sales, you needed to get a hard disk in there?
Sure, and it was. And again, you know, when I first met the engineers in the Mac side of the house, I said, "Look, it's very simple. What we need to do is to put color." Slots and a hard disk, you know, on the Mac. And everybody around the table nodded, said yes. So I said, what this is about? Why didn't you do it before? You know, of course, because that was not the official idea before. So I bought myself a license plate that said Open Mac, which I put on the back of my on my car, T-shirts that reproduced the license plate, and we set out to do the Open Mac, which ended up being a 2-year project. In the meantime, as interim, we quickly came out with the Mac Plus with an external SCSI drive, which and more memory. And I remember Bill Gates saying, what, 1 megabyte of memory? Nobody needs more than 640K.
Well, He's famous for that. Yeah. I bet he wishes he'd never said that.
There was a very bad reason for that, which was the original PC hardware could only address 640K of RAM. So the Mac Plus was a sort of interim product that reassured people that the Mac had a future.
But the goal was the color Mac, right?
Yeah, and so in 87, so the Mac Plus was shown, launched on in January 1986, and in March of 87, we went to Los Angeles and we launched the color Mac, the Mac 2, but also the Mac SE. The Mac SE had a noisy fan, sorry about that, but it had an internal drive, so instead of the Mac Plus with an external SCSI drive, you now had an all-in-one box with enough memory, enough hard disk, and a faster processor, which was then followed by the SC30, which used the 9830 Motorola processor, which was really, really fast for the time.
That was a beloved computer. I remember so many people had that.
And we took care of the noisy fan, and the Mac was then a product line that had the compact version and the expandable version with color and everything.
So that went really well for a few years. I think those were the heyday, 87 to maybe 91, 92.
Yeah. So then
Microsoft started thinking about a version of Windows operating system.
Yeah, well, you know, the problem for Apple was not Windows. I think in January of 90, I had dinner with John Sculley, and John asked me what I thought of him, and I was not very diplomatic, and so I was fired for good reason, because we had been butting heads a few months.
What was the key difference of opinion there?
I don't want to get into that. John is my benefactor. You know, he gave me a very interesting job, several promotions, fancy titles when I was president of the product division, with also getting manufacturing and product marketing. But it was time for me to go, because, if you're a number two guy, disagrees too much with you, you have to break the situation. And so John is my benefactor, I can't say good things about what he did for me. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. So was this when you were started thinking about B?
Yeah. So let me make a quick detour. In June of 87, after the Mac 2 and the Mac SE were launched, I get a promotion, a bonus. We are basking in the successful temporary turnaround of the situation. Now the Mac product line was considered as very attractive. And then one of my key reports walks into my office, and he says he wants to leave because he wanted to do something which turned out to be a slate type of computer, like a tablet, like a letter. Mm-hmm. Letter format tablet. He had some ideas, and I said, no, don't leave. I'm summarizing things. So we set up a separate division for him on Bub Road in Cupertino, and this was the birth of what got called the Newton. But the Newton was not what we saw later. It was a full page tablet, with a very fancy Ethernet and power connection with processors from a company called AT&T Microelectronics, a small but really attractive RISC processor called the Hobbit. And
so you developed a full page device which didn't see the light of day, and then became
You had a pen, you could write on the screen. So the concept underlined the word concept.
Interesting.
Was very attractive. And then when John freed me, when John fired me, I talked to the gent who had invented the Newton, and I said, "What are you going to do?" He said, "Oh, you know, if you're gone, I'm gone." So I said, "Well, let's start a business together." And by the time, this was 3 years after the start of the Newton project, 87 to 90. By then, we became convinced that handwriting recognition would not work. So we sort of left the Newton behind, which was then re-engineered to a smaller screen, half of the original size, with a different processor and everything, and the handwriting, never worked. And for a while, people thought that the gentleman Steve Sackerman and I were doing a PDA, as the word became known. But no, we were doing a multimedia computer, basically. That's what we set up to do.
Was the technology at the time just not quite ready for what you wanted to do?
With Newton or with B?
With Newton.
With Newton, no. It's handwriting recognition still doesn't work very well. It's a very complicated, very, very, very complicated problem. It will work someday, but, I'm not interested in science fiction. I'm interested in products. Things that work, that you can sell, make money, and not being sued for.
So then your mind turned to a elegant, modern operating system that was well beyond the primitive Mac OS, and Apple was having troubles about that time because they were desperate to get away from the original Mac OS.
I made a ancient. When I left Apple, I since John had been generous with me, I said, "Look, why don't you kill?" There was a parallel project to write a new operating system for the Mac called Pink.
Ah, yes.
Why don't you cancel Pink and blame it on me, because it's not going to work. I became convinced that not going to work. And we know what happened.
And it didn't work. It was called Copeland, and it didn't work.
Yeah,
it had problems with developers. I mean, it worked, but it was too big a thing for the developers to swallow, as I recall.
The credit to Steve Jobs to have seen that, and instead of killing the Mac when he came back, he kept the upper layers of the Mac as alive as possible, and used a computer scientist that he brought with him from Next, Avi Tevanian,
Bertrand Serlet.
Yeah, Bertrand Serlet and Scott Horsell, mm-hmm. among others, to slide a proper Unix-based foundation under the user interface layer of the Mac. So it was an extremely, extremely delicate endeavor, and its success is really you know, should be a testament to Steve Jobs' vision in the first place, and to the skill of the technical people he brought with him.
Let me back you up there for a second. So you had been developing B outside, and Steve was lobbying Guillermo to adopt the next operating system as the solution to the failed Pink. But you were in there too, competing.
I was in there, and you know, in the end, we know what the decision came to be, so as it were. And I think bringing Steve Jobs, I mean, you know, let's give Guillermo credit for seeing that bringing Steve Jobs would really, really give legitimacy to the next phase of Apple's life.
Yeah, that saved the Mac. Really did.
Yeah, well, it saved Apple because Steve came with a lot of ideas. For example, when I came in 85, I was looking for a management team to help me work things out, because you might recall that we had to merge the Apple II division and the Mac division. So my first you know, staff meeting, I had 29 direct reports, which you know, is a little much. So I was trying to get a small cadre of managers to help me. So people tell me, look, if you want someone to run Mac engineering, you know, just the hardware engineering, there's this guy in the cubicle. So I see this guy, Steve Sackerman, that Jobs had hired the year before from HP, where Steve Sackerman worked at the Corvallis division. And what was Steve Sackerman working on? Well, he was working on a Mac phone. I kid you not, Mac phone. In 1984, Jobs had idea about a Mac phone. So he knew that there was something that he needed to that his instinct told him that there was a need to do something on, you know, with phones, which we know came to pass. I think hiring Steve Jobs back is is much to Guillermo's credit. Of course, Steve being Steve, promptly disposed of a few people, Guillermo, Ellen Hancock, and others. But he kept a finance executive that Guillermo, who himself is a gifted financial person, Fred Anderson. So Fred Anderson engineered the cleanup of Apple's balance sheet. So, you know, Steve has an eye for talent, and we know what happened then. The Mac was revived by various design, especially the first iMac, the Bondi Blue iMac, by a gent that had been down in the bowels of the organization, called Jonathan Ive, or Johnny Ive. So, you know, Steve discarded some people, kept some. You know, my admiration for Steve has many dimensions, but one of them is that he was a great editor. You know, the best thing Apple did for itself and for Steve was to fire him in 85. He went on to make Pixar a success. Mm-hmm. And if this is all what you do in your life, you're already a captain of industry. And then he started Next, which technically was an amazing achievement. Remember that at CERN, the computer that ran the first HTTP HTML protocol.
Tim Berners-Lee.
Yeah, was an X machine. I got to see it. I got to see it at this CERN, visit. But commercially, Next was not a success. So Steve came back at Apple, armed by the success of Pixar and the commercial but technical, the mixture of success and failure of Next, and then he knew what to do at Apple. When he worked at Apple, all he knew was Apple. He knew nothing else. And being forced out in the real world was a great thing eventually for the company.
His exile into the wilderness with glorious return.
This is really what happened.
Well, we're running out of time, but I want to reserve a few minutes here at the end to kind of fast forward us to the current day. I wanted to ask you, because of your Monday note and your really good analysis of what's going on with Apple, would you like to talk about Tim Cook and how you feel about how he's doing and the challenges? Do you think he's doing anything? Do you think there's anything he's doing wrong?
Of course, he must be doing some things wrong. You can't run an empire such as Apple and do everything right. What counts is the not the bottom line, which precisely is not what Tim Cook is focused on. Tim Cook said very rightly, and I admire him. I love the guy, I'm biased. I admire him for his courage.
Among I do too.
And so Tim said, no. We focus on the product because we know the money will come. Of course, he's no fool. He's not going to sell products at a loss or anything. But as I think I wrote in the Monday note on another topic, you cannot drive a company by using an Excel spreadsheet as your windshield.
Explain that.
Well, if the first thing you look at is the income statement or the balance sheet to drive the company, then you're not seeing customers, you're not seeing technology, you're not seeing social trends, and all that stuff. In the end, the company's money is in the customer's pocket.
I think what you're saying is that if you track the money too closely, you get into an unstable resonance.
Yeah. You get fixated on ratios, KPI. Of course, all these things are important. If you don't make money, you die, and that's that sort of thing. But the focus is where can the company make a difference in the life of customers, a difference that customers will value enough to pay for it. And then can the company build the physical product or the service so that it is solvent, it is making money.
Do you think that's the motivation for Apple rumored to be getting into an electric car?
That's above my pay grade.
It doesn't keep us from having opinions.
No. Of course, and you know very well that I do have opinions. If Apple makes a car, a putative car, it would cost about $50,000. All right, $50,000.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that number.
So to sell that number is very far from the products that Apple sells today, which cost a small multiple of $1,000. It's a different culture. I'm a great believer in the power of cultures, especially the unseen power of culture, the things that are in our gut that shape our perceptions, unseen to us. You know, if you are of a different religion, and then you go to a beach in the south of France, you are offended. Maybe you're offended, but you know, it's because of your religion, not because people do bad things. I don't know. I mean, you know, of course, if it would be fun to see Apple do such a car, but I think in the meantime I'm waiting for the next wave of Mac.
Yes, we all are. This is getting very painful. There's a website that's tracking the number of days since the update for every Mac.
October 15th. I don't know. I don't have. Let me look at the calendar. What is October 15th? October? No, that's a bad day. Well, October 11th. All right, October 11th or 12th. We'll have some news in my. I don't have, you know, because you can't do things past mid October.
That's right. Holiday season. Yes.
So now we're talking about the mid-October, Tuesday 11th, Wednesday 12th.
Do you think there's any hope for the scientific and creative professionals in terms of the Mac Pro, or do you think Apple's going to just stay with the iMac and drop the Pro?
Well, the iMac, as if you... with the next generation of processors that Apple... will soon enough use, you'll have a very powerful iMac with a big screen, all in one, silent. Of course, you know, there is no substitute for cubic inches, as we say in America. But I think the iMac is for a lot of people. You know, the Mac Pro didn't sell very well because the difference in price compared to from an iMac and the power is it's not convincing. Hmm. It's not convincing. I'm sad about that, but. It is not convincing. Apple hasn't come out with a 5K independent screen, which I hope they do. So we'll see. In the meantime, I think the new iPhone is a very good thing. I think the new the updated watch is also, especially for exercise. You know, it's now you can swim with it. It's faster. It has GPS.
Some of the TMO team members have said it's remarkably faster and a joy now.
You know, it's there you have it. I'm a fan of Tim Cook. I'm sure he makes mistakes like all of us, but overall, I think he's doing a fantastic job.
Cool. Well, that just about covers it. We have really covered a lot of territory, and I want to thank you for joining me and giving us this wonderful story about your career and your background. So thanks again. We all on the Mac Observer team were excited to have you on the show, so thank you.
Thank you.
As a wrap-up, if the listeners want to contact you, how would they do that?
My last name, Gasse, G-A-S-S-E-E. At mac.com.
Excellent. Well,
I'm
listeners,
superstitious, so I'm keeping that. I'm keeping that that old email address.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like it too. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show. This has been fascinating. We'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.